From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. At the White House today, President Donald Trump signed a proclamation honoring Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Through his bravery and sacrifice, Dr. King opened the eyes and lifted the conscience of our nation. He stirred the hearts of our people to recognize the dignity written in every human soul.
Well, this follows enormous outcry that the president yesterday, in a meeting with lawmakers, may have used a deeply vulgar term to describe Haiti, El Salvador, African countries, and immigrants from those countries. Trump tweeted this morning that he used, quote, tough language, but appeared to deny using the vulgarity. The White House, however, did not deny it yesterday.
And on Capitol Hill today, Senate Democrat Dick Durbin said he was in that meeting, and he heard exactly how the president responded to a bipartisan deal on immigration. And a warning now, Senator Durbin uses the offensive language.
He said, Haitians, do we need more Haitians? And then he went on when we started to describe the immigration from Africa that was being protected in this bipartisan measure. That's when he used these vile and vulgar comments, calling the nations they come from shitholes. The exact word used by the president, not just once, but repeatedly.
All right, let's get to our Friday politics roundtable. Chad Pergram, Fox News senior producer for Capitol Hill, is here. Hey, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Jose Diaz-Balart is news anchor for Telemundo and NBC. Hi, Jose.
Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. So, look, we should say that your brother, Mario, is a Republican congressman from Florida who was in the room with Trump when he made those remarks. Now, your policy is not to speak to your brother about anything work-related, and we're going to respect that. But Dick Durbin—
Also, just to make a point, yeah. I have not spoken to him since
good.
This.
Okay, good to know. Look, Dick Durbin was in the room, and he has spoken. Just tell us, how are those comments going over in Washington today?
Well, I mean, look, it's just disgusting. You know, to hear that in a meeting when they're talking about immigration, and we're talking about people who are here and who are trying to make a new life for themselves and their families, people who have overcome deep and severe adversity. And if we're talking about Haiti, today is the anniversary of the Haitian earthquake in 2010 right. That killed from 100 to 300,000 people in the Western Hemisphere's poorest country. And these 56,000 Haitians who have been in the United States since then under TPS who are now going to lose that TPS. You know, to talk about people like anybody like that, that you come from a place that is difficult, poor, and but these people that are here are contributing, and it's disgusting, it is repulsive, it is, however, I think important that I think about this because of the many times I've been at the White House, not under President Trump that many times, but under previous administrations, and when there are off-the-record conversations with a president, sometimes presidents can use salty language. The question is, is this a time to be using this kind of language?
Right. Chad, why don't you jump in here? What are you hearing on Capitol Hill? We've heard from lawmakers from both sides of the aisle here who have condemned this speech. What else are you hearing?
Right. Well, you're going to have those sorts of condemnations, but you also have another set of members, frankly, from both sides of the aisle, certainly those who don't appreciate this sort of language, but saying, here we go again. Some people said immediately, does this complicate this debate to get an agreement on DACA and avoid a government shutdown a week from today? Frankly, under conventional circumstances, it would, but we are in unconventional times. And those issues, trying to get an agreement on DACA for the Dreamers, trying to increase defense spending and avoid a government shutdown in about a week's time, those issues are so complicated. It's like multi-level chess. So even though you have this severe comment by the President of the United States using very profane terms, it doesn't seem to be impacting that. And I should point out that Dick Durbin said something interesting about how he doubted that he had ever heard or there had ever been such language used in the Oval Office. I would remind folks that go back and read Master of the Senate by Robert Caro about Lyndon Johnson and some of the foul things that he is quoted as saying during his time in the House.
How about listening to some of the Watergate tapes?
Certainly, and I was also going to mention, you know, Nixon in particular calling out Dick Cavett, the television host, and talking about his religious faith, Judaism.
So can I jump in here? Because you make a good point, right? I mean, salty language has been used in the Oval Office before. And on the one hand, I don't think anybody should be surprised that President Donald Trump may have said something like this, because he is also the man who began his candidacy calling Mexicans criminals and rapists. The bigger issue to me, though, is in reference, in using this language in reference mm-hmm. to nations like Haiti, mm-hmm. El Salvador, etc. Let me just ask the both of you, is he betraying an attitude about people from those countries because of who they are? In other words, an attitude along the lines of race and immigration.
Well, sometimes, you know, this is sort of crystallized in what actions you see him take. The administration and him in particular have been criticized for how they address the hurricane in Puerto Rico, tossing paper towels around. The Republican Party has real problems with the minority voters. We're facing a midterm election here. There were a couple of key retirements just this past week announced from Republican members in California.
Daryl Issa, a very prominent congressman.
And that's a swing district. You start to wonder, is this the sort of thing that builds a wave? And I talked to some Democratic lawmakers here prior to the comment, and they were talking about how energized the minority communities, the Latino communities, the African-American communities were going into this election because of how they were perceiving the DACA issue.
And, Chad, I'm glad you brought up Puerto Rico. I just want to bring up a quick update, because we're nearly four months after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, millions of Puerto Ricans, U.S. citizens, and close to 40% of the island still does not have electricity. Think about that for a minute.
And another point on that, you know, what has not been talked about much in this debate about funding the government by the end of next week is this disaster bill. You know, they moved a big mm-hmm. disaster bill for the wildfires in California, the hurricanes in Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands through the House. It has not been moved through the Senate. And I've been shocked this past week. I've heard scant conversation here on Capitol Hill about attaching that in some form, modifying it, and attaching it to that interim spending bill that they hope to move next week, or even when they're going to address it. There's not a lot of bandwidth. They will address it at some point. But again, you know, they tried to do this before Christmas. It didn't work out. And now we're in mid-January.
Look, there is some other context here. And that is that some Republicans, some conservatives do seem to be supporting what the president said. Ann Coulter appeared to be pleased by what the president said. She tweeted that maybe the president is trying to win me back. We remember earlier this week, the president seemed to soften his stance on immigration when he was meeting with a bipartisan group of lawmakers. So cynics will say that he could be playing to his base, but I just wonder if you're cynical enough to believe that, Chad.
Well, here's where the issue comes, and I talk about the midterm elections. Just this morning, Martha McSally, a moderate Republican mm-hmm. congresswoman from Arizona, announced that she's running for the Senate. And if you look at her ad, she talked about how she was close to President Trump. She was in these meetings trying to work out something on border security and immigration. Arizona is an emerging state that is turning purplish. That is going to be a seat that's in play as Jeff Flake retires right now. And to be associating yourself with the president in a swing state when you're a moderate, and then he comes out and says this at the same time you announce your candidacy, and that's in your ad that I got at 5:30 this morning. Wow, that's going to be a problem for Martha McSally.
Jose, your thoughts?
My thoughts are that it is, I think it's to be expected that when a president or anybody else is speaking off the record in the privacy of his office or his home, whatever that may be, that he can use salty language is one thing. But to talk about people who are suffering and who have come to this country and who are contributing in such a fine fashion, like the Haitian American community, like the Salvadoran community, like the Honduran community, the Nicaraguan community, and so many other communities, South Sudan, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, that are here under TPS and other ways. And to talk about these people who are following the American dream and who are participating with honesty, dignity, and with such respect for this country, to talk about that as being maybe it's just not the words he used as much as what he was referring to.
Well, there is some fallout here. I mean, we're just seeing today that the U.S. ambassador to Panama, John Feeley, who's a career diplomat and former Marine Corps helicopter pilot, has resigned.
And can I point out something about that? You know, there's a little bit of a misnomer on that. He had actually announced that he was leaving yesterday.
Right.
Fox News has confirmed that. And then there was a statement that, no, he's resigning because of that. There's some reporting out there that that's the case. But according to our information here, that's not the way this went down with the ambassador from Panama.
I see. I'm seeing Reuters has seen an excerpt of his resignation letter. And he said that his instructors made clear that if he believed he could not serve in an apolitical fashion under the current administration, he would be honor bound to resign. And that time has come. So we'll see how this unfolds as it continues to do so. Chad Pergram, Fox News senior producer for Capitol Hill. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
And Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor for Telemundo and NBC, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
The video game industry had a banner year in 2017, hailed by insiders as one of the most remarkable periods in the industry's history, both for the wide array of games and for the increasingly diverse audiences they attract. Austin Walker is editor-in-chief for Vice Media's video games outlet Waypoint. Austin, good to talk with you.
It's great to talk to you. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. So 2017 being a banner year, what stood out for you?
You know, a lot of things. I think one of the big things that happens sometimes in gaming is there's a new piece of tech or something that everyone gets excited about. But that wasn't the case in 2017. It was a year in which people got excited about stories, about new types of gameplay. And these are games that dealt with things that were on the forefront of people around the world's minds. Things like economic duress, things like racism, LGBTQ issues. Games are exploring these things now in a way that they haven't been before.
So that's really interesting because video gaming, and I guess just about every form of entertainment, part of the attraction is it being a respite from the challenging realities that we all face. But those realities are now making their way into the games themselves.
Yeah, you know what? I'd say that in 2017, gaming provided an outlet for stress and anxiety, both as a respite to escape those things in something like The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, where you have this beautiful kind of open world adventure where you're climbing over hills and looking off into beautiful vistas, but also in games like Night in the Woods, which kind of deals with economic recession and coming home from college and dealing with parents, or even games like Wolfenstein, The New Colossus, a game that dealt with fascism in America. You had games that actually engaged with some of those anxieties. And so you kind of got both things from gaming in 2017, which is exactly what we want to see.
That's really interesting. You know, I have to say, I take back my earlier comment about games supposed to be a respite from all those realities because, you know, I think about books and movies,
right,
et cetera, and those are places where the culture really engages with these thorny issues. So why not video games?
That's exactly it. I think that 2017 was a year that showed that to some degree, games as a medium and the gaming industry was growing up. These are games from big studios dealing with these complex issues. You know, Wolfenstein was published by the same studio that made the fantasy game Skyrim, which was a huge success a few years ago. But Wolfenstein's entire premise is that there is already a sort of strain of fascism in the American political imagination that in their kind of fictional alternate history world, the Nazis are able to capitalize on. And so something like that, even though it's a shoot 'em up, even though it's a first-person shooter like Call of Duty, it's engaging with anxieties that are really at the forefront of the American imagination right now. And I want to see more of that going forward.
Yeah. So we talked about the kinds of games, the increasingly diverse types of games that people are playing. What about who's playing? Is that getting more diverse?
You know, it's getting a little bit more diverse, and partially that is because we're seeing a change in the sorts of games that are being made and the types of ways that you can play those games. You know, I look at a game like Butterfly Soup, which is made by a very small team. It's kind of a story-driven game, not like Mario or Pac-Man or something like that. It's almost like an interactive novel that follows the lives of queer Asian youth in Oakland. As someone who's a person of color who grew up who didn't see myself often in games, knowing that there are games for those audiences is fantastic because it means that when you see yourself inside of a medium, you recognize that that medium can be for you too.
You know, Austin, this is really interesting. And video gaming is such a massive multi-billion-dollar industry that it's great that it's getting more diverse in terms of its content and who plays. But I don't want to be too laudatory here, because what about who's making the games, right? I mean, like it, like any other industry, has had a problem with a lack of diversity, misogyny, that kind of thing.
More than a small problem. I think a deep systemic problem that we have not always seen eagerness to address. There is a lot of defense of company culture, especially in the blockbuster space of gaming. We've seen more tools for small developers, for more diverse developers to get into the game. But we haven't always seen that same sort of added diversity in the workplace. There are real issues inside of the games industry that in 2018, I really hope that we see publishers and studios work towards addressing.
Right. So since you mentioned 2018, what are you most looking forward to?
You know, I'm really interested in being surprised. I think that one of the great things about 2017 were these little games from small designers that no one had ever heard of before, the sort of art house hits. But I'm also hopeful, or I would love to see more games continue to tackle these kind of national anxieties. I want to see games that actually deal with issues like racism and misogyny and class issues, and not just from a sort of like, this is a hot topic, hot button issue, we'll get some press from it sort of way.
Right. Well, Austin Walker is editor-in-chief of Vice Media's Waypoint. Austin, thanks so very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, there is a relatively unknown game that I just learned about. It was created by a father to help his young daughter cope with a devastating diagnosis. His driving force was a statistic that said the jobless rate for blind adults in this country is close to 60%. So he got to work and created something called Beckdod.
Want to do it? Here, let's do a cow.
I met Jake LaCourse and his wife, Beth, their babbling 2-year-old Rebecca, and 8-year-old Reagan on a frozen January night in New England. Rebecca was in Dad's lap at the dining room table. They were playing the game he created for her.
Look, look out. There you go.
A little over a year ago, Rebecca was diagnosed with a rare and cruel genetic disorder called Usher syndrome. She was born profoundly deaf. A pink headband keeps her cochlear implant in place, and at 2 years old, her vision is already going.
Worst case, she's completely blind in her mid-teens. Best case, she has her vision for her entire life, but what ends up happening, that peripheral vision really starts to close in, and it's like looking through a pinhole. So that's what the prognosis is for her.
LaCourse believes his game can help Rebecca learn Braille, and here's how it works. There are 4 large Braille cells and an electronic port on the game board, which is about the size of a laptop. When Rebecca puts a toy cow on top of the port, the gears turn. And the Braille dots that spell out the word cow pop up in the Braille cells.
So then we can move over to, like, this is a little pig, pop the pig on, and it'll pop up the word pig.
And you can hear the pig oinking or the cow mooing.
Correct.
And Rebecca actually likes it.
What we love to see when she plays with it is all she tries to do is take her finger and mash the dots back down. But that's her learning.
LaCourse is a product engineer by day, so he has experience making things. He wants to sell the toy for under $100. The idea is to help little kids learn early Braille concepts to get them ready for a long journey of adapting to a world that's built for people who can see. Ike Presley, with the American Foundation for the Blind, says it's not the first time a parent has built something for a blind child.
Yes, this was back in the 70s.
The Opticon was created by a Stanford engineer named John LaVille, whose daughter Candy couldn't see.
And it was a system that used a little miniature camera that you could roll over print, and then it was connected to a box that had an array of vibrating pins in it, and the pins would vibrate in the shape of the letter.
At the time, it was a high-tech innovation and widely used. Presley says Jake LaCourse's invention probably won't help kids develop the fine tactile skills they'll need to read much smaller Braille cells, but he says there is value to the work he's doing.
It gives him an opportunity to actually do something besides just sit around and wait for the doctors or, you know, whoever to come up with a miracle cure.
Back at home, little Rebecca is demanding slices of cheese and storming through the kitchen wearing her mother's snow boots. that go all the way up to her hips.
Mama!
She's trying your shoes on. Those are too big for you.
Rebecca is a typical toddler, but when her mother, Beth, got the news that her daughter had Usher syndrome, it didn't seem like she would be. Just about 20,000 people in the U.S. are thought to have it. And what's typical about a child going deaf and blind?
I was just sick for days. I didn't want to leave the house.
As parents do, she had envisioned a life for Rebecca even before she was born.
I want her to be able to play sports and musical instruments. I want her to have friends. I want her to be good in school and math. All of my hopes and dreams that I had for her kind of came crashing down, you know.
And still, it's difficult.
Her night vision is going now. She says, when she's in a dark area, she says hi constantly just to get the feedback so that she knows you're there. So we're constantly saying hi back to her so that she knows we're right next to her.
But someday, they won't be. When I asked Jake how his daughter's descent into blindness was affecting him, he waved the question off in a way that said it was just too raw to go there. But then, later, I asked another question. Did he create the game to teach his daughter Braille as a way of dealing with his pain? Yes.
Beth calls this my way of coping. It definitely is. And you know, and I the thing that really helps me is raising awareness so that eventually we could be a small part of...
Jake's eldest daughter, Reagan, can see that her dad is about to cry. The 8-year-old darts across the kitchen, throws her arms around his legs, and looks up at him with a goofy smile.
Toothless. Be a small part of finding the cure, right? So that's really what we want to do.
And that's exactly what he's doing. The day after we met, Jake was in Las Vegas to be honored at this week's Consumer Electronics Show. Yesterday, Jake's toy, BeckDot, won the 2018 Not Impossible Award for its ability to break through barriers.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Most Olympians don't get year-round attention or make front-page news. But in a few weeks, winter sports of all kinds will be in the spotlight in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Colorado Public Radio's Rachel Estabrook introduces us to one athlete at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs who's working hard to try to represent the United States in the sport known as skeleton racing.
Veronica Day will be the first person to tell you that she didn't get into this to be famous.
I'm never going to get any name recognition doing skeleton.
Skeleton, the Olympic event in which Day barrels down an icy track on a small sled, head first on her stomach at 80 miles an hour. Yes, with a helmet.
It can be weird, I guess, that I'm like competing on the highest level and then have no one even know what I'm doing. But I mean, you could say that about any other niche sport, and there are a lot of them.
Niche, like most Americans only pay attention to it for a couple of weeks every 4 years. Not too long ago, even Veronica Day did not know that much about skeleton. She was a track and field athlete in college, not good enough to go to the next level, she says. But in 2010...
I was sitting in my college apartment with my three teammates, and we were watching women's bobsled.
It's the final day of competition at the Whistler Sliding Center. The final two heats.
The announcer would say, oh, so-and-so ran track for this university. And so all my roommates were track athletes. I'm like, we run track. We can make a bobsled team.
The rest were joking, but Day was serious. She filled out an application, found skeleton was a better fit, and within a year, she was on the track in Lake Placid for her first run.
And it's the most fun you'll ever have. I mean, you don't have no idea what you're doing. The coach just, like, kicks you off the side of the mountain and is like, have fun, see you at the bottom, bye. And finished the run, I was like, take me up, I'm going again.
She made the national team and moved to Colorado. There's no ice track here, but Day can do the rest of her training to prepare for the all-important push start, those first few seconds before she dives onto the skeleton sled. In the training center's main gym, Day sprints on a lane of artificial turf on the gym floor. On one leg, she's going faster than most people can on two.
And then I just did some accelerations and some jumping drills. And now I will go into the sled pushes and then sprints at the end.
This is a sprawling facility where even the dumbbells are tattooed with Olympic rings. A 50-meter sprint track has pressure plates underneath to dissect how an athlete runs. And one room here can mimic almost any environment in the world in terms of temperature and altitude. After the workout, on the floor at home, she stretches out her legs and puts little plastic cups down on each thigh.
It feels like a vacuum is sucking the skin off of your body.
And it leaves red circles.
When you do them on your back, you look like a stegosaurus. So you got a whole bunch running down your spine.
The therapy is called cupping. It's supposed to relieve pain and help recovery. Day's not sure it actually works, but she needs any advantage she can get. The U.S. Olympic skeleton team will be chosen later today, and Veronica Day needs to be one of the top two or three women in the country to make it. Whoever makes it to Pyeongchang for the U.S., they'll have a slight advantage this year. Three of the top skeleton finishers from Sochi are Russian. They were caught up in the doping investigation and have been banned from the Olympics for life. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Estabrook in Denver.
Rescue efforts continue today in Southern California after rainstorms triggered massive mudslides earlier this week. At least 17 people have died. Others are still missing, and search teams are using long poles to probe for bodies in the mud and thick debris. I spoke with Francis Rengers with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's a member of the Southern California Debris Flow Team.
The threat really isn't over, and the area could be susceptible to debris flows again, depending on the rainfall. So the rain is the driver, but I think an important takeaway for people in the area is to know that the threat isn't gone if it rains again.
Well, and it doesn't take very much rain. I mean, I'm reading that to trigger a landslide in California, especially after such a big fire, that as much as 3/10 of an inch in 30 minutes can cause one of these slides.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things our group does is we use statistics of past events to develop rainfall probabilities. So in that area, our prediction was about a half an inch in an hour could cause a debris flow. And what we saw in Montecito, one of the rain gauges showed half an inch in 5 minutes.
And all that rain, it changed the life of Charles Crail and his family. He lives in Montecito. He and his wife, Tawny, and their two dogs were at home when the mud came crashing down. Charles, welcome. We're so sorry to hear about what you're going through. How are you doing? How's your wife doing?
I'm fine. My wife was actually had pneumonia, and when they evacuated her, it was really difficult. She was so weak, she couldn't really get up and to get to the evacuation vehicle. We had to go through over boulders and telephone poles and wreck cars and all kinds of stuff. So it was difficult for her. She's in the hospital in intensive care, but now will be taken out to a regular room because she's gotten better. I'm fine. I didn't have any problems at all.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, that just makes everything so much more complicated. Could you take us back to early Tuesday morning? I assume you and Tawny were at home. I mean, what happened? Did the mudslides wake you up?
Tuesday morning around 3:30, I woke up because it looked like daylight. The entire sky in every direction, when we look out any window, north, south, east, or west, was bright orange. It looked like the most glorious sunrise in Arizona that you could ever think of. I mean, it was literally daylight.
Why?
And that came from an explosion that happened up next to the San Ysidro Guest Ranch, which is a famous resort a mile, as the crow flies, or a mile and a half from our house. And a gas leak had taken place in this old mansion, and it filled up with gas and exploded, and it blew up the house and 12 houses around it.
Oh,
a lot of those houses were caretakers' houses and guest houses and so forth on the property. But that's what got us up. There was no flood at that time. And then we went back to bed, and not more than 20 minutes later, it started raining so hard I couldn't believe it. And I went to the window of my bedroom and looked out, and what it was a beautifully landscaped, almost like a park. It looked like a tributary of the Mississippi River, with cars going by, pieces of houses, and roaring.
Wow.
And maybe 8 feet high.
I can't even imagine what you were thinking at that point. I mean, was your instinct to rush outside to see what was happening?
No, my instincts were to stay inside, because I was afraid if I went outside I would be swept away. Huh. So we definitely stayed inside. I wanted to make sure all doors and windows were locked and secured, because I felt the water would be coming up soon and trying to get into the house. I then went to the front windows, looking out towards the street. We live on a street called Olive Mill Road, which is one of the more damaged streets. And again, all the landscaping, walls, trees, I redid this house about 20 years ago, so there were huge, mature trees gone. Every single stick, everything. Our cars were in a heap, and the street became, and our front yard was indistinguishable.
Well, and what about your house? Did the mud get through the windows and through the doors? Is your house okay?
Our house is a miracle. Both houses on the north and south of us, neighbor houses, were destroyed. Our house, somehow, the mud came up to the edge of the windows. It never came in, and nothing inside the house was damaged. So we were absolutely, it's a total miracle that this house didn't just get washed away. The one right below our house, you wouldn't even hardly know it was a house. Window's gone, all the furniture's gone, everything's gone.
And these are your neighbors. Are they accounted for? Yeah. Are they okay? Do you know what? We know people died in this flood.
The lower house, people all were away. I've talked to them on cell phone. The house to the north of me, I've not been able to reach that neighbor, and he doesn't answer his cell phone. But the fire department has gone through all these houses, so he must have been away. They would have found something.
Look,
but there's been a number of deaths on our street or in the neighborhood very nearby.
Look, Charles, hindsight is 20/20. I'm sure if you knew this was going to happen to your home and to your neighborhood, you would have left. There was a voluntary evacuation order for your area before the storm, I understand. Do you regret not leaving now?
When this event was predicted, they made mandatory evacuation above Highway 192 up into the mountains all the way north. But below, it didn't become mandatory till after the fact. So we felt, and I've lived there since 1972, I've been through other floods. I've never seen that part of the Montecito flood like this. So I think, in my opinion, the mistake was that they should have made that whole area mandatory, and most of the destruction was in the involuntary area, although there was a lot in the mandatory area.
Well, I know you have your son, Devin, there with you, and you're in Santa Barbara right now at his home where you're staying.
That's correct.
Can you put Devin on the line?
Sure. Hang on.
Hello?
Hey, Devin. You know, I'm listening to your father tell this story, and I know that you were involved and have been to their home as well. I mean, what are you thinking when you hear this story about what your mom and dad went through?
It's unfathomable. I first was woken up. My brother lives about a mile away east of my parents, and he called me around 4 a.m. to say that it was a river on both sides of his house, and he just washed his cars float away and bounce off the house, and they were hunkering down on the second floor, waiting to be rescued. And that's when I called my parents to see how they were doing, and they were in a similar scenario. I was in total shock. They were trying to describe what was going on, and I couldn't imagine it.
You went there afterwards?
I did. I tried to go there on Tuesday afternoon, because when they were evacuated, it was so hard for them to get out. The firemen wouldn't let them take any of the bags they had packed with their medication and and passports and all that stuff. So I, and then a neighbor of my brother's said he had seen people in the neighborhood carrying lots of purses and looking like looters. So we, that was a worry as well. So I tried to get in on Tuesday. I walked the railroad tracks for a few miles and then up all of Mill and made it about three houses away and got turned back because it was still a very active rescue scenario, and gas leaks and water mains broken and a lot of water still flowing.
Do you wish that your parents had heeded those voluntary evacuation orders and made it out of there before this storm hit?
Definitely, in retrospect, but nobody could have ever imagined that that would have happened. If it had been a mandatory evacuation, I have no doubt that they would have left. But I don't even think the experts could have imagined what would happen.
Well, you sound like a good son. Thanks very much. That's Devin Crail. His father, Charles Crail, and his mother, Tani, were in the path of that mudslide there in Montecito, California. Devin, Charles, thanks to you both. Good luck and best wishes to Tani, who I know is still in the hospital.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Northern Ireland is in the midst of a crisis with hints of something people there have seen before. During the decades-long period known as the Troubles, thousands died as Protestants and Catholics clashed. The Good Friday Agreement of 1998 set up a power-sharing government between the Protestants, or the Unionists, who wanted to stay in the United Kingdom, and Catholics, or Republicans, who wanted Northern Ireland folded into the Republic of Ireland to the south. Well, that power-sharing system collapsed a year ago this month. Its legislative assembly is idle, and politically speaking, Northern Ireland is paralyzed. The BBC's Chris Page joins us from Belfast. And Chris, this power-sharing government was born out of the peace accord that ended years of bloodshed. Is it going too far to say that as this crisis drags on, the collapse feels potentially very dangerous?
Well, I think people are saying that, yes, as long as this political vacuum continues, the state where Northern Ireland doesn't have a government, no one's quite sure where things are going, well, that is a bad state of affairs. Now, nobody's really contemplating the possibility at the moment that we could go back to large-scale violence such as that we saw over the period known here as the Troubles, when, as you say, almost 4,000 people died in a very bitter conflict which lasted the best part of 3 decades. However, the divisions in society here between Unionists and Republicans, between Protestants and Catholics, as you said, still very much do exist. And as long as that division is still there, many would say that the peace process, which has really on the whole been very successful over the last 20 years, has to be guarded very carefully. Fact is, if there is a division in society, then that threat of violence will always exist. So that is why people see this moment for Northern Ireland as potentially being very serious. And it's been marked and discussed over and over again, this week in particular, as it's a week since the power-sharing regional government effectively collapsed.
So what was the political rift that split these two parties apart and caused the government to collapse?
Yeah, well, the two parties in the power-sharing coalition were the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin, who are an Irish Republican party. Now, historically, Sinn Féin was the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, the paramilitary organisation which took most lives during the Troubles. There were other paramilitary groups who wanted to keep Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom too. Now, whenever you look at the partnership between those parties in power, well, it was certainly never going to be easy, and that proved the case. The final row between the parties came over all things involving a green energy scheme, which was run by DUP ministers and went well over budget. But there are many other divisions between the parties. For example, the Democratic Unionists are opposed to same-sex marriage being introduced in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin think same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. You have a big disagreement over whether there should be legal recognition for the Irish language. Sinn Féin want legislation for that. The Democratic Unionists don't. And then there's also disagreement over how new agencies to investigate hundreds of unsolved killings from the Troubles should operate. So all these issues are what's separating the parties.
Well, here in the United States, I think a lot of people would have a hard time imagining what it would be like if there was no legislature for the course of an entire year. I know just before the collapse of the government there in Northern Ireland, there was big plans for a healthcare overhaul. Obviously, that's not happening now. I mean, what else is not getting done?
Well, certainly you're in the situation where civil servants, government officials are running Northern Ireland, but because they are officials and not elected politicians, they don't have the power to take any major decisions. So you've got a whole range of unmade decisions that are piling up, areas like infrastructure projects, road building projects that are overdue sign off. You had a huge report published into the future of healthcare in Northern Ireland just before the government collapsed, recommending a radical restructuring to bring the health service up to date. But that plan also hasn't been fully signed off. In every area of life, from health to education to infrastructure, you'll get people saying, we really need a government back in place to start making decisions and getting things going again. Also, in terms of business confidence, business leaders will say political instability is not the sort of thing that's going to encourage investment.
Wow, interesting. So for that reason, is there any thought that Northern Ireland might end up getting governed by direct rule from London?
Yes, that possibility is certainly being raised, and the Democratic Unionists say that if an agreement can't be figured out really in the next few weeks to bring back the regional government, well then the government in London, the British government, will have to put in new ministers to run Northern Ireland, basically take back control of Northern Ireland. But that will be opposed by the Irish nationalist parties, including Sinn Féin. They say that instead what should happen would be some kind of joint arrangement whereby the British and the government of the Republic of Ireland will get together and try to work out all these issues.
Well, as we know, Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. There have been tense discussions about the future of the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland once the UK does finally officially leave Europe. I wonder if any of that ties in here.
Yes, I think it does. Of the two main parties at the centre of things, the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, campaigned for Brexit. They are for the UK breaking with the European Union in as strong a way as possible, basically. You have Sinn Féin calling for Northern Ireland to be awarded some kind of special status whereby it actually remains in the European Union even if the rest of the UK leave. So it's certainly another level of complication here.
The BBC's Chris Page in Belfast. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.